From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Celeste Headlee. This episode, a look at how technology is affecting education.
And all the kids are doing on their iPads is taking notes. Then they probably would have been better off investing in more spiral notebooks.
Our cover story, when is technology worth the cost in the classroom? Then the recession may have hit men hard, but the recovery is hitting women even harder.
It was funny that I sat down and thought about it. Huh, the people who got the job were men.
Also, selections from round 10 of our 3-minute fiction contest. And writer Jamaica Kincaid publishes her first novel in 10 years.
Sometimes I feel that there is a certain kind of book that I should have written that is expected of someone like me.
Plus, the mystery behind the music of Rye and the African-American composer who deserves to be remembered, celebrating Margaret Bond's 100th birthday.
It's jazzy, it's bluesy, it's spiritual, and Tchaikovsky rolled into one.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. This hall at Westlake High School in Maryland is just like thousands of other school hallways all around the country. Kids milling around, laughing, chatting on their way to class, and there's nothing remarkable about the door where 30 kids file through to take their seats. The room is pretty unexceptional as well. Sky blue cinder blocks on all sides, no windows, rows of desks. But in the front of this classroom, there's no podium and no chalkboard. There are two enormous flat panel screens. There are thin white microphones hanging in four rows across the ceiling, and this is the only room in the high school that's fully carpeted. That's for sound control, because the lectures that happen here are not your normal high school lectures.
Good morning, everybody.
A dapper, bearded man in a brown vest greets the students, but this isn't the teacher. This is a historian, speaking from his apartment in New York via Skype.
But if you look at this period in American history, after the death of Abraham Lincoln...
Schools are spending billions on educational technology without knowing whether or not it helps kids learn. And that's our cover story today. Is the tech worth the cost? Kenneth C. Davis is the author of Don't Know Much About History. The AP history teacher at Westlake asked Davis if he could talk to his students about America in the late 19th and early 20th century. So Ken encourages the kids to ask questions, speaking clearly into the mic.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Ravancho, and I was going to ask you about Grover Cleveland and how he was the only president to not have a consecutive term and why you thought he went back and tried for a presidency again.
Okay, Grover Cleveland. I spoke about him very briefly.
The kids remain attentive for the entire hour of the lecture, but are they learning more than they would from their teacher? Although Davis doesn't charge for his time, this room cost Westlake High School tens of thousands of dollars. James Massia teaches English at Westlake. He says it's worth it because he's been able to bring in all kinds of interesting people digitally to engage with the students.
We've teleconferenced with Dave Barry, which was a lot of fun.
Senior Jayla Briscoe was there when that comedian and author Skyped in to talk to kids.
I didn't even know who he was before then. I didn't really know much about him at all. Actually, he got me more interested into writing.
Massia's class also spoke over Skype with poet Nikki Giovanni. And next week, students will watch the live dissection of a cadaver safely at a distance through the big flat screens and the digital microphones. Historian Ken Davis has given many of these lectures for schools all over the world. And though these are only virtual appearances, Davis says he doesn't feel removed from the students.
In fact, I've been amazed at how really, truly immediate it is. And obviously, this does enable me as a writer based in New York to go to places I would otherwise never get to. This isn't just about the Skype. This is about grassroots movements of teachers to use this new technology to open up their classrooms to a much wider world. I call it the connected classroom.
But technology is just a tool, Davis says, and it has its limits.
I've seen teachers completely dedicated to making their students interested, enthusiastic, energetic learners, and using this technology is just one of the tools to do that. This isn't, you know, this is not the panacea, and I don't want to present it that way.
That sentiment is echoed by James Massia, the high school English teacher at Westlake. He says Skype lectures work because the teacher still has control and it's still a communal learning experience.
I probably wouldn't want to give every kid a laptop in class. It's not as controllable, I should say, as something like our telepresence center. You know, you'd have to monitor the kids a lot more.
However, schools across the country are spending billions on various kinds of technology. Kristen Purcell is with the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. She just co-authored a new study on technology in the classroom and says schools aren't just investing in computer stations and keyboards.
I think what did surprise us, though, was the extent to which mobile tools have become a part of the learning process. 73% of the teachers that we surveyed told us that cell phones are now either part of their classroom experience or their students' classroom experience. Tablet computers and e-readers are being used by more than 4 in 10 of these teachers.
But so far, there's been no good way to measure how effective all this technology is and whether or not it's actually helping kids learn. In some districts where schools have invested heavily in computers and e-readers, test scores have remained the same or even fallen. Dr. Howard Pittler is a former high school principal and is now the chief program officer at McCrell, an education research and development group. He explains the challenge of measuring the change in student engagement while learning with tech in the classroom.
It is a matter of engagement, and standardized tests as we know them today don't measure engagement. If we're doing, for example, a Skype conversation, and all we're doing is talking to an expert who's doing a talking head lecture, that's not going to really increase engagement. But if, for example, we've got an advanced Spanish class in a high school Skyping with video pals in Spain or in Mexico, and they hear the accents and the inflections and have Spanish conversations, that changes the engagement. It shows them a reason for learning.
Isn't there enough danger here, though, of increasing the gap for kids in poor districts as opposed to wealthy districts? I mean, there are some districts that simply can't afford the Skype lecture or the laptops for the kids or the smart boards. Are they going to get left behind?
There's a gap now. There will probably continue to be a gap. However, the technology itself has changed so substantially that a Skype lecture is something within the realm of every single classroom. A teacher with a smartphone and a cord to a projector can do a Skype lecture or a FaceTime lecture using their own phone.
Pretend that I'm a school teacher and I have a smart board in the front of my classroom, or I have a chance to use Skype technology or some of these other techs that schools are investing in. What would you tell me?
Doing what you've always done and just putting electricity behind it isn't going to change things. When we see a school that's brought a one-to-one iPad initiative in, for example, and all the kids are doing on their iPads is taking notes, then they probably would have been better off investing in more spiral notebooks. But if what they're really doing is investigating, using simulations, going out and participating in real-world projects, then we see a real change. Recently, where we were watching kids do simulations at the atomic level, they were taking simulations of atoms and molecules. They were able to manipulate them, tear them apart. In the classroom without the technology, they would either be watching a video of this that the teacher was showing, or they'd be looking at pictures in their book. But now they can actually have that in their hands on their iPads. There's a company that sells a microscope, a USB microscope, that broadcasts its signal to all the iPads in the classroom on a closed network for that class. And so the kids actually see what the teacher's doing up front, and they're able to record and manipulate what the teacher's doing. So it changes from a teacher-based to a student-learner-based environment.
How receptive are school districts to investing when parents are saying, look, there's 31 kids in this class, you need to bring down your class sizes? Or when parents are saying, you're losing music class, why would you invest in a projector?
You said something about the digital divide, and the real digital divide is between us adults and the kids, because the kids look at this environment and say, that just is the way we operate after the bell rings at the end of the day. Why would you take that away from me at school? But teachers and administrators that are running the schools oftentimes don't understand the technology. And so they're afraid of it. When you think about it, though, most preteens and teens have Skype or FaceTime accounts. They go home, and getting on a webcam and talking to friends is a normal thing for them. We look at it as this new, innovative, strange thing because we haven't quite figured out how to leverage that. And it's possible that if you just ask the kids at a high school, so here's what we're going to be learning about in physics. How could we use webcams to help us with this?
Does that turn the kids off when it's suddenly this technology that they enjoy so much at home becomes part of their educational experience?
I think it's quite the contrary. It's when kids are told, and here's exactly how you have to use this technology. I want you to go to this website. I want you to click on this picture. Then it becomes more of open this textbook, read page 47. What I believe the teachers have to be in control of is the content, the learning objectives, and the targets the kids need to meet. We don't know as adults near as much about the technology and what's out there too often as the kids do. So we try to build walls around it and restrict it. What we really need to do is define what the end needs to look like. Kids, this is what we need to learn, know, and be able to demonstrate. Here are some technology ideas that'll get us started. Now let's build a wiki or a Google site and share additional ideas, share our work, and maybe involve a school in another state or another country to share our work and grow as learners.
That's Howard Pittler of McCrell, an education research and development group. The digital divide between school districts with greater access to funds and those with less is still a major issue. Kristen Purcell of Pew Research points out that low-income schools are lagging behind.
Teachers who were teaching the lowest income students were more likely to tell us that they do not receive formal training in the use of digital tools in the classroom. They also express less satisfaction with the support and resources provided by their schools. And they're much more likely, they're three times as likely to say that their school is behind the curve when it comes to using the newest digital tools.
And that, she explains, makes the real difference in the classroom experience, both having the technology available and training the teachers in how to use it, so it becomes a learning experience and not just an expensive distraction. Another effect of the sequester, women workers could be hit disproportionately hard. Federal office and clerical jobs filled largely by women could be on the chopping block, according to Bloomberg. Gender gaps in the workplace, though, have been a long-standing problem. Last year, full-time working women earned just 80% of their male counterparts, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Though it had seemed during the recession that women might be making strides, female-dominated industries like healthcare held steady despite the downturn, while male-dominated industries like construction suffered. Overall, men lost twice as many jobs as women in the recession, according to the Pew Research Center. But now that employers are hiring again and the job market is slowly picking up, it looks like women are once again getting left behind. That's the story of Nkechi Feaster.
I didn't expect it to get as hard as it has gotten.
At the start of the recession, she was working as a receptionist at a Washington, D.C. law firm. When she got laid off, she found another office job. But soon the axe fell again. She thought her luck had finally turned around when she got work in a military hospital. But the Army closed that facility and left her in the same hard place again.
Since I was the last one in, I was the first one to let go. And that was going on 2.5 years ago. So each layoff has gotten longer and longer.
Feaster wound up losing her home and moving into a shelter. Luckily, she's since found an apartment with the help of a federal housing program, and she hasn't given up looking for work. But I asked her if she's surprised that it's taking so long.
Oh, absolutely. You know, with me, I don't have a degree. I don't have tenure at one job. I don't have one job title over the course of my career. I've been doing office work, admin, for 11 years, but it's been receptionist and clerk and this and that. So I know there are things lacking on my resume that can keep me from a job, but I'm still a very marketable employee. So the first 3 months, I didn't feel that bad. I understood it was a recession. I understood it was going to be harder than normal to get a job. But I did not expect things to go downhill. After each layoff, it took longer, and it got harder and harder. And what I realized is the reason that even the temp assignments started to dwindle is because everyone was out of work. Those with degrees, those with tenure, those with more experience than I had. And even now, you know, I've been on some awesome interviews, but I really didn't expect to be still out of work.
You know, the recession's been over. We're now in a slow but steady recovery. Okay. And yet men are getting jobs at 4 times the rate of women. You're mm-hmm. nodding your head already. This doesn't surprise mm-hmm. you.
No, not at all. Not at all. And, you know, like I said, I know what is hurting me. You know, I know what things I am lacking. But still to see most of the jobs that were referred to me by someone I know, it was funny that I sat down and thought about it. Huh, the people who got the job were men most of the time.
So how do you make it? Is there a time limit on how long you can cobble together?
Well, I can say after 2.5 years of not having a job, things are pretty dire. But no, I don't have a limit. Because of such unexpected times, I can't put a limit on it. I can't say, okay, I'm only going to look, you know, for another 6 months and then, but what do I do after that 6 months? You know, do I just stop completely? I can't do that. I have to keep going until something happens.
In Kichi Feaster, she's still struggling to get rehired in the recovery. So why is it so hard for women job seekers to make that something happen? I spoke with Mary Gatta, senior scholar at Wider Opportunities for Women, a nonprofit research group. She explained why women are getting left behind in the recovery.
As the economy began to recover, we began to see men outpacing women in terms of the job gain. So men were gaining jobs and continue gaining jobs at higher rates than women. And compounding that is even during the recession, although men's unemployment rate was higher, the wage gap was still very real. And in fact, women during the recovery began to lose jobs, particularly jobs in the public sector.
We just got a study from the Census Bureau that finds there are more men becoming nurses. When they take on the job of nurse, they're out-earning their female counterparts, even in the same job title. Explain what's going on here.
Nursing has traditionally obviously been a field that's about 92% female. And while women still make up the bulk of that labor market, men have made some inroads. But what we began to see happening is what happens in many traditionally female jobs, is that men out-earn them. Some people call this a glass escalator, that men ride glass escalators to quicker advancement and higher wages.
We hear the term gender gap all the time, but what is that gap?
I mean, the wage gap is not new historically. In fact, we can trace the wage gap back. The earliest measures are back in Paris in the 1300s. Part of it is what we call, sociologists call the gendering, right, of occupations, and that historically we did not think that women were working to pay for housing and food, that they were working for what was called pin money, kind of just extra money for spending, which is not the case at all. 2/3 of women today are either the primary or co-breadwinner of their families. But when we're thinking within these very gendered mindsets that women are not a main economic contributor, we don't think about paying them fairly.
What's the silver lining here, Mary? Please tell me that there is one.
You know, we still have a ways to go, and there's a lot more work to be done to ensure equality in our labor market. We have made progress, right? The wage gap has shrunk. But I think what is also a silver lining is that we're talking about this more. So women are more aware of the fact that they need to better understand the occupations that they're in, the earnings that they're getting. So the more education and awareness we can do on the part of workers and also on the part of employers. Lots of times employers do want to do good. And if we can help provide employers with the tools to make sure that they're paying their workers fairly, that is another benefit.
That's Mary Gatta, senior scholar at Wider Opportunities for Women. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you very much.
You ready for the tick, tick, ding? We're reading the best of the best from round 10 of our 3-minute fiction contest. The challenge this round was to write a story in the form of a voicemail message. And next week, our judge, Mona Simpson, will announce the winning story. Our graduate student readers helped us out tremendously. During this contest, they combed through more than 4,000 entries and helped us select the top stories. We had readers this round from some of the top creative writing programs across the country, including Vanderbilt University, Cornell University, and University of Iowa. First up, we have an excerpt from a story called The Escape, about a bride making a tough choice on the eve of her wedding day.
Hey, Julia, it's me. Kind of glad you're not picking up. This will be easier, maybe. So here goes. I'm going to ask you to do something for me. It's not an ordinary best friend kind of favor. God, I wish it was. I wish I just needed you to pick up my dry cleaning or something. Anyway, here it is. It's big. I need you to somehow explain to David, and I guess everyone else, that I won't be there on Saturday. I just can't do it. This won't make any sense. I know. You'll think I'm insane. Everyone will. I'm at the airport right now. I'm getting on a plane in a few minutes to Guatemala.
That was NPR's Tamara Keith reading an excerpt from the story The Escape by Lisa Toronto of Asheville, North Carolina. Next up, an excerpt from the story Three Little Words.
Yeah, you were right that before we move forward in this, I have to say those three words. And you're absolutely right that no relationship between two people can work without getting around to saying them. Someday maybe we'll say them to each other all the time and give each other a kiss and go to work. I'd like that. But still, you know, they aren't easy to say out loud the first time. The thing is, I've never actually said them to anyone else. You're the first. Well, my mom, of course, and my dog Wiggles. He was my dog when I was 7, a Labrador retriever. I said it to him sometimes when I was by myself. But you're the first time I've really said it and meant it. But I'm ready. I really wish it wasn't on a phone message, but I can't wait any longer. So here it goes. I was wrong.
That was NPR's Bob Mondello reading an excerpt from the story Three Little Words, written by Rick Hodges of Arlington, Virginia. You can read both of those stories in their entirety at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. That's 3-minute fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And be sure to tune in next week when we announce the winner of 3-minute fiction, round 10. Author Jamaica Kincaid is back with a controversial new novel, her first in 10 years. Perhaps best known for her books At the Bottom of the River and The Autobiography of My Mother, Kincaid's new book tackles some hard themes. See Now Then opens with a scene of seemingly idyllic home life in small-town Vermont, but it's soon clear that the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Sweet is anything but sweet. The book traces that marriage's painful unraveling in an unusual narrative that bucks the traditional style. In the decades since Kincaid's last novel, she says she's kept busy writing and trying to figure out how to make this book work.
It's not a book in the usual way of and then, and next. It doesn't have what you'd call a traditional structure or a traditional narrative, but it is very structured, it's very mannered, actually, in the way your mind might work. I mean, I've come to think that the traditional way of writing is the artificial way, that that's not the way things work at all. It's not the way thinking works. And in the book itself, I mean, it made sense because the characters in it are not like characters who cross the street and brush their teeth. They never brush their teeth. You'd think they must be very fragrant people.
They're not flesh and blood.
No, they're not. They are mythic.
Yeah, and you've named many of the characters after Greek
mythology. That's right.
And mythology.
That's true. The son is named Heracles, and the daughter is named Persephone, and they're always described as the beautiful Persephone, the young Heracles.
Well, Persephone was beautiful, but she was also the queen of the
underworld.
Dead.
Yes. She was the queen of the dead, but she was captive and away from her mother, and her mother mourns for her and longs to see her. And so on. And all of those things are particular to the story. They're symbolic in the story, and they are also real in the story. The book operates on two levels, you know, with a sort of reality and then a sort of interpretation.
I mean, as you were alluding to earlier, it's not chronological. It almost is like a dream in that things just happen. And because of that, and the title, and the fluidity of time in the novel, I wonder if maybe time isn't the real flesh and blood, real character, memory.
Oh, you must have really read this novel. Time is the main character. Time is the element that controls the consciousness, the very being of the people. I started out thinking, what is this thing we call time? And it started in this way. Every day I see a photograph of myself taken when I was 2 years of age. And I would look at it and wonder, well, what happened to that two-year-old? Where did it go? And there are all sorts of explanations. You know, we grow up, we grow old, we change. But none of it is a good explanation for where is the two-year-old. And so it's from that, really, I began to contemplate all the things that had happened, how I came to be the person sitting in a small village in New England.
And that's kind of the subplot to me, anyway. What I took away was how our memories are created, and you can't trust them. I mean, you don't even know in the novel what is real and what it isn't.
Yes.
And you have created some scenes that are graphic and horrifying.
Yes.
Visions of decapitation. It's as though you're trying to suggest that we can't trust our own memory.
Yes, but that is, that is wholly true, that you can't trust it. For one thing, the thing that is happening to you might be so unpleasant, you may need to subtract from it or add to it so that in the retelling, you can manage it.
You know, a lot has been said and written about the parallels between this book and your own life. The mm-hmm. the main character, Mrs. Sweet,
yes.
is also a writer. She
yes.
also lives in a small New England town.
Yes.
She also is an avid gardener.
Yes.
I don't have to go through all of them. There are a lot of parallels.
Yes.
But I wonder why it matters. I mean, if it's a great piece of art,
that's the thing that is interesting to me. Why does it matter? It doesn't matter to me that it's autobiographical, but it seems to matter to people as a way to read it, you know. Except I think it's a way of diminishing what's, I think, might be remarkable about the work. And it's painful in its way to be dismissed because, well, it's about her marriage and revenge or something. It's not that at all. None of that was on my mind. My own everyday life was not on my mind so much, but how to render something that had happened, how to make sense of it. You know, men write about their life all the time. You know, Norman Mailer would put himself in his books.
It's true.
And no one made it seem that he was doing something less.
No, they were just drawing on personal experience.
Yes. I do have to say that I notice, and I don't like to say these things, but I just think it has to be said that if I had looked different, my autobiography in the book or any kind of autobiography in the book would not be held against it.
You mean if you were not a female or if you were not from Antigua, if you were not dark-skinned?
All of the above and more. That sometimes I feel that there is a certain kind of book that I should have written that is expected of someone like me, the travails of the black woman, the travails of history. There is all the travails of history certainly is in the book, but it's not about the black woman or the black this. It's about a human experience that the life of this family doesn't depend on the color of their skin.
No, although the husband is racist, and his family was too.
I wouldn't say they were racist. I would say that they didn't understand her, and she didn't understand them. Why are they racist?
Were you asking me why I thought they were
yes.
racist? Well, I mean, the continued emphasis on her coming in from a banana boat, the continued assumptions they make about her
uh-huh.
based on where she came from, and based on her race.
That's not the way I meant it at all. That particular section, you know, has to do with the history of certain powerful actors, for instance, the British Empire. It's her foreignness, not her race. Race is almost not the way I think so much, but I see that it's something that is attributed to me and the way people perceive me is my race. I perceive the world as powerful and powerless. And Mrs. Sweet comes from the history of the powerless. See, the thing about race, one can imagine that if the world had gone the other way, we'd be talking about these things in a different matter. I mean, if you look at life in a way as a kind of musical chairs, and when the music stops, who's sitting down and who's standing up? At one point, it very well might have been that the people from Europe are the ones doing the standing up, and the people who look like me might be sitting down and pushing them around. It's all very arbitrary. It's why you can't take these things not only for granted, but you can't assume that they're fixed. They're always in flux. Maybe not in our lifetime, yours and mine, but they're in flux.
Jamaica Kincaid, the new book is called See Now Then. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time now for music. In this case, a bit of a musical mystery. Last year, an unknown band called Rye started posting exquisitely produced videos online. The images were sexy, erotic even, and the music matched the images. The names of the band members were unknown, intentionally shielded from view, and listeners started wondering, who is that woman singing, and why don't they show her? But once information started leaking about the band, admirers were shocked to learn, that's a dude. Don't run away. Don't slip away, my dear. Rye is the all-male duo of Robin Hannibal and Mike Milosh. That's Mike singing there. Their debut album, Woman, comes out on Tuesday, and throughout, Milosh sings in that same soft voice.
It just felt right for those particular songs to be in that part of my register. It wasn't like an intentional thing. We would be working on a song, I would start singing some stuff, and it just, that's what felt right to do.
Some of the initial reactions when your music was anonymous, when it first started appearing online, people immediately compared you to Sade. They compared your voice to Tracy Thorns or Sinead O'Connor. Those are obviously all female. What did you think?
Personally, I don't view myself as sounding like a woman. I understand a lot of people have. I think I just have a soft quality to my voice, and then people immediately associate that with something extremely feminine. And I mean, that's fine. I mean, it's not like I'm offended or anything like that. But it's an interesting thing to have people think you're a girl, and you're definitely not.
Let me address this particular air of obscurity that surrounds you guys. Mm-hmm. Your first time your music appeared on the internet, you were anonymous. You didn't appear in those videos yourselves. Other people appeared in them. I understand that for the New York Times interview, you requested that your faces be obscured. I read an interview in Interview Magazine, which they said they weren't sure which one of you was answering the questions. If it is part of your PR scheme, congratulations, it's very effective, but it has to be in some way intentional, right?
I can't say it's not intentional because we made a conscious decision to stay out of things, but it wasn't a PR scheme. It's not like something that we create out of gimmickry or whatever. We just didn't want to be in the imagery of it because we wanted people to have their own experience with the songs. Like truly, I mean, Robin and I talked about it at great length. So that's how we both love exploring music, especially when we were younger. Is that you hear something, you become intrigued by it, but because of the song, not because of the image around the song. Because we're going to play live, and people are eventually going to see who we are. It's not like we're going to be going up there with a black cloak and, you know, to lead with our actual images just felt like it was the wrong decision, and it's just more important to let the music be out there on its own.
I mean, I can understand that. I can understand the distaste for sort of the pursuit of personal aggrandizement, right? And yet at the same time, fame gives you opportunities, right? I mean, it allows you to reach way more people with your music. There are upsides for a musician to being famous.
obviously there's some opportunities that come from fame that you didn't have before, but there's a lot of dangerous pitfalls as well. And there's something about making music without the intention of becoming a celebrity that I think is much more in line with our value system. I'm not terribly interested in the idea of fame. It's like the sun.
I'm speaking with Mike Milosh and Robin Hannibal. They're a duo together called Rye. The debut album is called Woman. Both of you were just falling in love, obviously, with different women while you're writing these songs. I mean, was it inevitable that this album would end up being all very, very sensual music? It's something that men especially tend to temper in their lyrics and their music for fear of presenting a less than masculine appearance. What did you think about that, Robin? Did it occur to you that perhaps your music might be too vulnerable?
I think you're right. I think a lot of people, a lot of male musicians or artists are scared of that. But I've always found that the honesty and sincerity and direct emotions makes it actually more, not masculine, but even more powerful.
Let me ask you about the stripped down nature of your songs. It does feel to me as though we may be coming around on the cycle that for a long time we've been really hearing a lot of pop music that's very loud and layer upon layer of different instruments and electronic noises. And we are beginning to hear, especially indie artists, have this more stripped down, bare sounds. Do you feel that this is a cycle, that the pendulum is swinging?
I would actually argue that there's more layers in a lot of these songs than a lot of pop songs. I mean, it's just very carefully worked so that it doesn't sound cluttered.
If you take Open for an example, there is probably between 80 and 120 tracks of orchestral arrangements. You know, there's harp, there's clarinets, bass clarinets, three different sorts of flute, three different sorts of saxophones, there's viola. I'm a fool for that shake in your thumb. Guitar.
Synth.
I'm a fool for that sound in your song. Bass. Drums. I'm a fool for your belly.
Yeah, but you guys are using a more like a symphony in which you can have an entire violin section playing and yet it doesn't sound noisy, right? It doesn't sound cluttered.
Yeah, I think it's what Mike was also saying, it's about arrangement, and that's what arrangement truly is picking the places where you have counterpoint and where you build dynamic and you build tension and then you release it again.
Yeah, if I could take this crazy liberty, I would say that the arrangements are specificist as opposed to minimalist.
Mike Milosh and Robin Hannibal are the duo known as Rye. Their debut album comes out on Tuesday. It's called Woman. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My nature, I ruin love. It's just my nature. kisses in those misses within. Stealing kisses in those bloody sheets. I'm killing you. I'm killing you. Stealing kisses in those misses within. Stealing kisses in those bloody sheets. I'm killing you. Crack their spine. It's gonna break, caving on itself. Love is terminal, not built to last. Burn bright, burn fast. Burn bright, burn fast. Stealing kisses in those misses within. Kisses in those bloody sheets. I'm killing you. I'm killing you. Stealing kisses in those misses within. Stealing kisses in those bloody sheets. I'm killing you.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time now for music.
I drink at every vine. The last was like the first.
You're listening to the work of composer, arranger, and pianist Margaret Bonds. She died in 1972, and today would have been her 100th birthday. Now, Margaret Bonds is perhaps near the top of the very short list of African-American women classical composers. Thanks to her partnerships with people like poet Langston Hughes and soprano Leontine Price, she's remembered in some circles as a very important figure in American composition. But for most of the country, she's been forgotten.
It's amazing that people don't know who she was, although she was quite well known in her time.
That's Louise Toppin. She's an opera singer and a voice professor at the University of North Carolina, and she hosted a Margaret Bonds symposium there this weekend.
Margaret Bonds was born in Chicago. Mother was a pianist, father was a physician. She's born into the time where you have jazz musicians from the Great Migration have come to Chicago. You have classical musicians that are also there, so it's a very rich musical environment. And she was noted as a pianist in her time, which people have forgotten that part too. She was the first African-American to play with the Chicago Symphony as a pianist on her senior year of college. That's extraordinary.
What you're describing is her coming of age, but at the same time, that choice to not only become a composer, but to compose classical music had to have been tough for her. Tell me exactly what led her to decide to write classical music.
She once described her stuff, some of her pieces, as it's jazzy, it's bluesy, it's spiritual, and Tchaikovsky rolled into one. And she studied with Florence Price, the African-American symphonic composer. And so with the influence of Price and some of the others who were now bringing African-American spirituals and folk music into the symphonic tradition. She was actually growing up at a time when that exploration was beginning to happen.
So let's talk a little bit about specific compositions. Troubled Water, this is one of the most performed compositions that she wrote. You're going to hear it's her take on the well-known spiritual Wade in the Water. Tell me about this piece.
It's a fabulous piece, and it was one of those that is published. What people don't know, so much of Margaret Bonds' works are still unpublished. I actually learned it when I was about 10 years old as a pianist. It was the first composition my piano teacher gave me.
She gave you Troubled Water? You must have been quite the pianist at age 10.
I was a pretty good pianist. She gave me that, and I was fascinated as a child to see a composition by an African-American because I hadn't. And as I started to learn the piece and the jazz influence, the extended techniques, you have to have a feel for jazz to play that piece, but you also get a good sense of what a fine pianist Margaret Bonds had to have been to play that.
I'm speaking with Louise Toppin. She teaches voice at the University of North Carolina. We're talking about composer and arranger Margaret Bonds, who was born 100 years ago today. Let's talk a little bit more about her lifelong collaboration with Langston Hughes. These two were very good friends, and she wrote many things based on his poems. So first, let's take a listen here. We'll begin with Langston Hughes himself reading from his poem, I Too.
I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong.
So now let's hear how that transformed once Margaret Bonds set it to music.
I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes.
What did Langston Hughes like about Margaret Bonds' settings?
I think that because they had a personal relationship, a friendship, they actually worked collaboratively for so long and knew each other, and she loved the way he told the story of African Americans in Harlem during this time, because one of the things that was important to Bonds was to promote not only her own compositions, but just the pride she had in African American artists.
Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen there.
A lot of people were drawn to her as an arranger. Leontine Price commissioned her as an arranger, among many, many others.
Absolutely.
She often crafted works specifically for who was going to be performing them. And I think that's true of the thing she composed for Leontine Price. Can you explain what we hear in these pieces that was specifically for Leontine?
He's got the whole world in his hand, for instance. She explores the richness of Leontine's ability to communicate in the lower register.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the
And then she gives you this wonderful climactic last section when she says, he's got you and me right in his hands. She knew how to build that energy and that enthusiasm to the highest point of Leontine Price's range. And she gives her a moment to really let go and bring the energy that you found in the church.
Oh,
ask you a personal question? Because, you know, the real tragedy for Ami Louise is that it's not like we now are surrounded by a plethora of African-American female composers even now.
Right.
Margaret Bonds is one of the rare few even today. Yeah. Describe for me that moment when you were 10 years old and your piano teacher sets a piece of music before you that's not Bach and is not Mozart and wasn't written by somebody from long ago or who looks nothing like you, but was another dark-skinned American woman. What was that like?
The fact that I can remember it tells you the impact that it had on me. I was floored. It set me on the path to find out more about Margaret Bonds, believe it or not, as a child. So that pride and that interest in her started my path of looking for more of her stuff, but also looking for women composers and recognizing that they are a rare commodity, but they have a voice in our musical culture and musical life. And she made very strong statements with the music that she wrote.
Louise Toppin teaches voice at the University of North Carolina Department of Music. We've been talking about composer and arranger Margaret Bonds. She was born 100 years ago today. You can find a link to the Margaret Bonds Symposium at our website, nprmusic.org. Ms. Toppin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To fling my arms wide in some place in the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done. Then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream.
For the week ending March 3rd, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our program from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Night coming tenderly, black like me. Night coming tenderly.